Studio 360 is supported by Arts Brookfield, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary with Art Set Free, a global art showcase offering emerging, established, and amateur artists everywhere the opportunity to share their art with millions worldwide. Details at artsbrookfield25.com.
Today in Studio 360, I've got a piece of advice for you.
In about 10 seconds, I'm going to turn the heat up in that chubby melon of yours, and I'm going to turn your brains to scrambled eggs.
Don't mess with Jessica Lange.
Shut up!
Yikes, sorry.
The rational and the reasonable, that stuff doesn't interest me as much as the emotional frailty or borderline madness.
I'm Kurt Anderson. I'll talk with Jessica Lange about playing way against type in the hit TV series American Horror Story. Plus, the book that invented adultery as we know it.
It's not clear who's after who and who's interested in whom, and that's all eroticized as well. Very sexy.
The Scarlet Letter, the latest in our American Icon series. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A long time ago, in an America far, far away, Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote a book about sex that is somehow still very much with us today, The Scarlet Letter.
We use it as a shorthand for blaming women for their own sexuality and turning that into a moral failing.
Our series on American icons continues with The Scarlet Letter. That's later this hour. But first, Jessica Lange. She started her career as the ultimate modern ingenue, the beautiful, helpless blonde in King Kong, then the sweet soap opera actress in Tootsie. But since then, most of the roles she's taken are darker. And lately, much darker. She leads the cast of the FX series American Horror Story. Each season is a totally new story and set of characters, all of them equal parts camp, drama, and the supernatural. And each season, Lange plays a different character. First, a supernatural neighbor, then a deranged nun, and now this powerful, ruthless witch living in present-day New Orleans. The other witches call her the Supreme.
I have been to St. Louis number one, and I have seen the tomb of Laveau, seen the fat tourists from Little Rock to Hackensack, drawing crosses on the bricks, making wishes to the bones of Marie Laveau. Little do they know. All they have to do to get their wishes granted was come down here to the Ninth Ward and get their hair braided.
That is Jessica Lange in the new season of American Horror Story. Your voice gets deep and growly. Was that a thing you had done before?
Well, it was something. Recent years, I've found that working through the voice is like a very interesting way into a character.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, because of her kind of presence and power, I just felt that a voice that had that kind of lower resonance,
yeah,
you know, almost a whisper sometimes, was an interesting acting choice. So that's, yeah.
You get in this series to perform these wonderful scenes and not just deliver a line to advance the plot, but these monologues that one doesn't see in television. And you get to do a different character every year. I mean, this seems like an ideal gig.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed it. I mean, I certainly have to say, you know, the idea of each season creating something brand new is what's kept me going. I don't know if I could. I mean, it's kind of the perfect world because you have 12 episodes.
Right.
So you have like 12 hours to establish a character and really kind of investigate it, you know.
But you're not imprisoned by her for 10 years.
No, you are definitely not. So at the end of those 12 hours, you're done with it. You've had more time than you would normally have in a regular film, but you're not compelled to try to keep this character interesting year after year.
Yeah.
So that has been for me, a great plus.
Looking at all the films you've done, was there after your big, oh, she's the King Kong girl, did you look around and say, nah, I'm everything I do or most things I'm going to do from now on are going to have some edge of weirdness, oddness, darkness?
No, not necessarily, but I did know, I mean, I know what attracts me as an actor to a character. And, you know, I had the perfect opportunity following up King Kong with The Postman Always Rings Twice, which is a very dark story.
Indeed.
And then Frances, which was the story of Frances Farmer, which got even darker.
Yeah.
Her fate was tragic. So I do tend gravitate to things that have, like, you know, characters that are kind of borderline, you
right.
know? I mean, the rational and the reasonable and that stuff doesn't interest me as much as the emotional frailty or borderline madness
yeah.
or any of these
or
other things.
Or full-blown madness.
Or full-blown madness.
Let's I'm going to play a clip, in fact, from Frances, which was your giant, wow, she's a great actress, breakout role in 1982. This is when she's been institutionalized. She comes back home and she's telling her mom, played by Kim Stanley, that she's going to give up her Hollywood career.
Frances, you can't do that. You can't do that to your fans. I mean, they stuck through this whole nightmare with you. You can't turn your back on them. They love you.
Ma, haven't you heard what I said?
I told him that he could come up here and that you would prove that you're all right, that you're cured.
I'm not cured. I was never sick. They had no business putting me in there. Now the only responsibility I have is to myself now.
You selfish, selfish child.
I remember playing that scene with her, and I pin her against the wall, and it wasn't scripted, but I say to her, get out of my way, old woman.
Get out of my way, old woman! Get out of my way!
And I could see something pass across her face. And when she slapped me really, really hard. And afterwards, she said to me, keep saying that to me. You've got to keep saying that to me. And, I mean, I just felt like, God, as a young actress, to be able to work with Kim Stanley was, like, such a tremendous gift.
It strikes me that the golden age of television came along on cable at the precisely perfect moment for you with American Horror Story and before that with Grey Gardens.
Well, the thing is, you know, there was a period of time where I really, to be perfectly honest, lost interest in it. And
that is acting.
Acting and filmmaking and, yeah. And I had grown kind of disenchanted with the whole process and the kind of scripts that were coming my way. Because there is, you know, if you follow a graph, there's a steep drop-off at a certain point in one's career.
You mean when you age out of certain number
Absolutely.
Of roles?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not like British actresses who then move into the next stage. The possibilities really dry up considerably. And I'd gotten lazy and disinterested and, you know, that reflected, I think, in my work. And and then suddenly, out of the blue came the chance to play Edith Bouvier. And suddenly I thought, oh, yes, this is what I love to do. This is something that thrills me to be able to, like, you know, take this character and somehow recreate it and make it personal and elaborate on the theme here. So it was that reinvigorated my love for acting.
Well, and you hit it out of the park, so it should have. Let's play a clip from Grey Gardens with Drew Barrymore.
I lived alone at least 30 years. I didn't mind. You get to be very independent when you live alone. You get to be a real individual.
You can't have your cake and eat it too in life.
Oh, yes, I did. I did. I had my cake, loved it, masticated it, chewed it. I had everything I wanted.
She was bored. She couldn't stand it.
No, I was not. I was a great singer. I had a perfect marriage, beautiful children. I had a terribly successful marriage. No, I never had a fight in my life. I never threw anything at Mr. Beale, never.
That is Jessica Lange in Grey Gardens. And it's funny that you say, I was a singer, because just in that clip, one hears the musicality of the voice you created to play her.
Well, Edith Beale was very musical in her. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, how these two women, living in that kind of isolation, mother and daughter, year after year after year, so delighted one another and carried on in what appeared to be, I mean, judging from the Maisel's documentary, an endless conversation. I thought that was just, you know, phenomenal.
Yeah.
And they developed this kind of music together, you know. It really was...
this ongoing duet?
Yes. It was like kind of a chamber,
yes,
you know, piece.
Yeah. You have worked with a lot of the great directors of our time, a few of whom are Sidney Pollack and Kosta Gavras and Tim Burton and Martin Scorsese and Julie Taymor and Wim Wenders. What do you feel like you need from a director to do your job the best you can?
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of these young directors probably don't realize this, and they don't engage with you. You know, this whole the video village phenomenon that happened, you know, in a decade or so ago.
Where they're all go off watching the video.
Where they're all sitting in another room watching a little screen. I remember with the great directors like Kosta Gavras, they were right there, as close to you as I am. And there was an exchange. There was this exchange of energy. You could feel like their almost love, you know, for you and what you were doing.
And the rapport was alive. Yeah.
And this encouragement. And it was really, it was an exchange of energy.
I can imagine.
And it also, there was a sensuality to it because they were right there with you, you know. Tony Richardson would have like a little no man's land zone where nobody was allowed, right next to the camera, and he would just move back and forth and follow you. I mean, it was really, and you could feel the presence of these men watching. And it wasn't, now it's very removed, you know. Sometimes I've even heard directors yell from another room to an actor, you know, giving direction, which to me is like, I mean, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. Because, you know, when you're working, you want that exchange of energy. You know, you want that kind of communication. And you want to feel they're invested in what you're doing. And then that makes your work better.
You said, after another year of American Horror Story, you're, quote, kind of coming to the end of acting. First of all, really? And or was that just something you said to say, I don't take this so seriously?
No, I do take it very seriously. I do. I feel, oddly enough, like, you know, maybe in another couple years, there are some things that I really want to do. You know, I have another season of this. I have a play that I want to do, maybe one or two films that I'd still like to do. But then I want, if I don't make something definitive, then, you know, things...
the same old thing will keep
things
happening.
Things just kind of keep going and keep going because it's... but if I somehow say, okay, I've got two more years to do this or three more years to do this and then I'm done, it's going to force me, like the old days, to begin a new adventure.
That seems... good. So this wasn't some casual flip. Oh, I'm done with acting. You have a plan.
I do. I have a plan afoot.
That's great. Jessica Lange, this has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
American Horror Story Coven is on FX now. And you can see what Jessica Lange's cultural diet has been lately on her 3 for 360. It's up at studio360.org.
We belong together. We're happy together. And life is a song.
When we are together, we know we are where we belong.
We belong together, like birds of a feather.
Together we thrive. Little caring weather, the rest of the world is alive.
Coming up next, America's original Gothic romance novel.
I think the thing that makes it so American, and is the thing that makes it modern, too, is that the real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy.
Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter in our series on American icons. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
America loves a good sex scandal.
Elliot Spitzer is indeed client 9.
Find out Kristen Stewart was cheating on Robert Pattinson with her.
Actually, America loves a bad sex scandal.
And Anthony Weiner now admits he sent additional explicit photos.
These days, we churn out a new one almost weekly. But way before we were all up in everybody else's business, a Puritan slept with her minister in one of the great American novels. Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, a book from almost two centuries ago that was set two centuries before that. WNYC's Anna Sale presents this episode of American Icons.
Make way, good people.
The Scarlet Letter opens with Hester Prynne stepping out of prison to a crowd of gawking townspeople. She's young, she's beautiful, and she has a baby in her arms.
Hester Prynne, you have been found guilty of adultery. We are loath to invoke the full penalty of the law.
This is from a 1934 movie version.
So if you would have us be merciful, reveal the name of him that tempted you.
No.
She gets a life sentence of shame. The Scarlet Letter was published in 1850, but it's still there, everywhere, in any conversation about sex, illicit desire, and humiliation. And it's one of those references you can throw around for literary cred, like in this Taylor Swift song that mashes together Hawthorne and Shakespeare. Romeo, it's shown up on The Simpsons and Roseanne. There was a modern riff with Emma Stone as a high schooler with a bad reputation. It was also on Twin Peaks.
Hester Prynne, pretty name.
During the interrogation of a prostitute.
I read The Scarlet Letter in high school just like you did.
I read it like most of American teenagers in a high school English class.
Tom Perrott is the author of a number of novels about sex and sexual politics in suburbia. Election, The Abstinence Teacher, Little Children. He hadn't read the book since he was a teenager, but he picked it up again before we spoke.
I actually loved it this time. It's a little bit unhinged, and I feel like they're just these unruly sexual energies that the book is like really struggling to keep clamped down, and I think I just clamped them down enough that as a teenager, I missed that, and as an adult, I see it and was really struck by the kind of contained craziness of it.
I remember feeling like it was weirdly sexy. I remember feeling sort of feminist about it.
Lindy West is a staff writer at Jezebel.
It's a very clear demonstration of the arbitrariness of a lot of morality and the way that that disproportionately affects women. So I remember feeling as a woman that this was something I should be paying attention to.
It's about a single mother. I mean, what could be more relevant, really?
Brenda Wineapple is the author of a biography of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
She's what they used to call a fallen woman.
Fallen, and she's kind of proud of it.
She took the baby on her arm, and with a burning blush and yet a haughty smile and a glance that would not be abashed, looked around at her townspeople and neighbors. On the breast of her gown, in fine red cloth, surrounded with an elaborate embroidery and fantastic flourishes of gold thread, appeared the letter A.
That's a kind of shocking image, I think. And then it becomes about what that means to her, what that means to her child, what that means to her lover, what it means to her husband, what it means to the community. And there are all these very different points of view about what that means, and they kind of change over time.
So the sin is out there, But what Hester won't reveal is the father's name.
"I will not speak," answered Hester, turning pale as death, but responding to this voice, which she too surely recognized. "And my child must seek a heavenly father. She shall never know an earthly one."
But the reader knows. It's the town minister, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. He's there at Hester's sentencing. Publicly, he urges her to name the father. Privately, he's a mess.
Arthur Dimmesdale, sodden with guilt.
That's Peter Coviello. He teaches English at Bowdoin College, and he's written about sex in 19th century literature.
Just Hawthorne's great expression of someone just riven by a kind of self-horror that he can't work out.
And preyed on, and preyed upon.
The person preying upon Dimmesdale is the other man in the book, Roger Chillingworth. He's Hester's husband, a much older man. He arrives in town to find Hester with her illegitimate baby. He pretends to be a physician and discovers Dimmesdale is the father. But he doesn't let on. Instead, Chillingworth manipulates Dimmesdale's insecurities to deepen his shame.
As he proceeded, a terrible fascination, a kind of fierce, though still calm, necessity seized the old man within its grip and never set him free again until he had done all its bidding. He now dug into the poor clergyman's heart like a miner searching for gold, or rather, like a sexton delving into a grave.
That love triangle between Hester Prynne, Arthur Dimmesdale, and Roger Chillingworth pulses through the romantic text.
Sex is always there. There's a kind of erotic overtone or undertone with Chillingworth and Dimmesdale.
This is a super queer book. The erotics of Chillingworth's really outsized and impassioned investment in Dimmesdale and his destruction is, in certain ways, the larger romance of the book.
Where it's not clear really who's after who and who's interested in whom, and that's all eroticized as well. Very sexy.
Like on the night the three come across each other in town, and a meteor flashes across the sky.
If the meteor kindled up the sky and disclosed the earth with an awfulness that admonished Hester Prynne and the clergyman of the Day of Judgment, then might Roger Chillingworth have passed with them for the arch-fiend, standing there with a smile and scowl to claim his own. So vivid was the expression, or so intense the minister's perception of it, that it seemed still to remain painted on the darkness after the meteor had vanished.
The Scarlet Letter has that sense of the claustrophobia of a small town, the sense of being watched by people you know all the time. Hawthorne knew that feeling. He was living in his hometown, Salem, where one of his ancestors was a judge at the Salem witch trials. So the Puritans were on Hawthorne's mind, even as some modern ideas about women were starting to take shape. Hawthorne biographer Brenda Wineapple says Hawthorne was right in the middle of it.
For a while, one of his very close friends was a very strong and sexual and outspoken woman named Margaret Fuller.
Fuller was a pioneer of what came to be feminism. She wrote a book that inspired the landmark Seneca Falls Conference on Women's Rights, which happened just before The Scarlet Letter was published. But to tell his story about a woman exploring the boundaries of personal freedom, Hawthorne looked back all the way to the 1600s.
Somehow those present issues became more real for him and more exciting if they were projected past.
Out of all this, Hawthorne created Hester Prynne.
She has no precedent. There is no American literature. There is no American heroine before her.
And Hawthorne had conflicted feelings about Hester.
She's forced into a position of infamy because she's pregnant, because she's an unwed mother, because she had to tryst in the woods with a minister. Not a good thing. And yet at the same time, she chose to go.
It's a strange book. It can't deal with sex, and yet it's creating the groundwork for a sexual revolution.
Again, novelist Tom Perotta.
I think the thing that makes it so American and is the thing that makes it modern too, though it's hard to see that, is that the real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy. And I think that's a specific American view of sex.
The Scarlet Letter's sexiest scene comes when Hester Prynne and Arthur Dimmesdale meet again, this time away from Chillingworth's watchful eye. Hester and Pearl are on a walk, and the child runs ahead. That's when Hester sees Reverend Dimmesdale walk past her, and she calls to him.
So strangely did they meet in the dim wood that it was like the first encounter in the world beyond the grave of two spirits who had been intimately connected in their former life, but now stood coldly shuddering in mutual dread.
The one-time lovers, at first, have no idea what to say to each other.
When they found voice to speak, it was, at first, only to utter remarks and inquiries such as any two acquaintances might have made, about the gloomy sky, the threatening storm, and, next, the health of each. Thus they went onward, not boldly, but step by step, into the themes that were brooding deepest in their hearts.
Hester reveals to Dimmesdale that his friend Chillingworth is her husband. Dimmesdale decides to leave town, and Hester says she'll go with him. They'll flee, start a new life together, and live happily ever after. And then the scene that the late novelist John Updike called one of the great moments in American fiction in an interview with NPR a year before he died.
First, she throws away the scarlet letter.
Hester tosses the scarlet A aside.
Oh, exquisite relief. She had not known the weight until she felt the freedom. By another impulse, she took off the formal cap that confined her hair, and down it fell upon her shoulders, dark and rich, with at once a shadow and a light in its abundance, and imparting the charm of softness to her features.
How wonderful the power of the hair, the mystery of the long hair let down.
John Updike wrote a trilogy based on The Scarlet Letter, each book retold from the perspective of one of the major characters. His 1988 book, S, is from Hester's point of view.
She's such an arresting and slightly ambiguous figure. She's a funny mix of a truly liberated, defiantly sexual and independent woman, but in the end, a woman who accepts the penance that society imposed on her. I suppose she's an epitome of female predicaments.
You know the female predicaments, the questions about how to get what you want within a tangle of obligations and expectations. Hester wants to be with her lover, and she loves him by protecting him. Those predicaments are still here, says Lindy West of Jezebel.
We're still dealing with these issues now, and this was something that Hawthorne was criticizing in the mid-19th century. That's pretty discouraging, actually.
And that's why the term scarlet letter is still ubiquitous.
I guess we use it as a shorthand for what we call slut-shaming now, which is blaming women for their own sexuality and turning that into a moral failing.
Lindy West pays a lot of attention to the contradictions in how people talk about women and sex on the internet. On the one hand, she says there's consensus that it's okay for American women to have sex lives. But if you want to condemn or humiliate a woman, go online and point out she has a sex life.
There are so many outlets to shame people for their behavior, to post pictures, naked pictures, or post details of people's personal lives that they don't want shared. It makes the stakes higher for everyone because it's not just hearsay anymore. People can bring up actual evidence. But on the flip side of that, the internet's also amazing in terms of women finding solace in community. I mean, Hester Prynne would probably have loved having a Tumblr. I mean, I think that could have really helped her out.
And the internet can also be a tool of revenge. Lindy West has become a kind of watchdog, and she brings a certain level of glee to taking on digital bullies.
People have figured out that we can use the same tactics to shame the shamers. If they say something horrible to me, I will retweet it with their face attached to it, and then all of my hilarious female friends will make fun of them. I mean, I will crush them.
Almost like Roger Chillingworth wanted to crush Arthur Dimmesdale.
Now I'm confused. Because isn't he the villain? Well, anyway, I guess I do. I am fueled by revenge. But my revenge is justified because they started it.
Hester Prynne may still be our archetype for a woman acting on her desires, but in the end, she doesn't get what she wants. Dimmesdale just can't follow through on their plans to flee together.
And of course, he can't do it. I mean, he's the same man he always was, and he was never able to be strong. But I think that Hawthorne is saying that's not a great thing to do anyway, because that would be another shirking of a kind of responsibility. These people have a responsibility to the community. They can't just take off.
When Tom Perata was writing his novel Little Children, he retold that story.
I suddenly realized, you know, there's a scene in Little Children where the adulterous lovers are on a football field and they commit to running away together.
Run away with me.
This is from the movie version.
What?
Starring Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson.
You don't mean that.
You believe in me.
But, you know, they have to make some arrangements. And, of course, in the intervening space, the man loses heart and finds that the courage leaks away. And so it really is a kind of clear reference back to this scene in The Scarlet Letter that I thought I had forgotten. But I think it's that kind of book. It becomes part of America's collective unconscious, and certainly American novelists' unconscious.
In The Scarlet Letter, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale does eventually confess his sins and promptly dies of a heart attack. Hester and Pearl leave town. But at the end of the book, Hester returns. She lives out her life there, becoming a kind of advisor to local women, talking about their troubles and love. All the while, she wears the Scarlet A.
In the lapse of the toilsome, thoughtful, and self-devoted years that made up Hester's life, the Scarlet Letter ceased to be a stigma which attracted the world's scorn and bitterness, and became a type of something to be sorrowed over, and looked upon with awe, yet with reverence too.
Hester is buried next to Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. This book is all about the tension between public shaming and public accountability. Nathaniel Hawthorne intimately details the inner lives of the transgressors and the enforcers, their individual motivations and hurts. But he's never totally clear on how he feels about the transgression. In this drama that centers on community judgments, Hawthorne withholds his.
I think the frustrating part of him is what's the wonderful part of him, and that is he's very brilliant, and he won't take a stand.
Hawthorne has a lot of stuff that's disquieting. He just kind of holds out here. This is discomforting and unsettling. Let's look at it for a while.
It's our anxiety. He induces anxiety in us, and we want to keep coming back and trying to understand.
I've been loving you.
For Studio 360, I'm Anna Sale.
A little too long. I don't want to stop now.
You can hear a longer version of our interview with the novelist Tom Perata at studio360.org. Excerpts from The Scarlet Letter were read for us by Amanda Quaid. And that's almost it for the premiere broadcast of our latest season of American Icons. But we asked you to nominate the work that's going to end this season of Icons. We got hundreds of excellent submissions, books, movies, songs, buildings, appliances, pink flamingo yard ornaments. We will reveal the winning listener icon on next week's show. Still ahead in this Studio 360... some of the best mistakes that science has ever made.
When you're a working scientist, the same as when you're a working writer, you're just living your life in that moment and working with those ideas in that moment, and you don't know that you're a loser.
Brilliant blunders and just the regular kind of blunders. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
It's a mistake.
Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. If you want to make an omelet, you got to break eggs. And if you want to make a breakthrough, you probably have to make some pretty big mistakes along the way. Some of them may lead to further discovery, but others will end up in the ash heap of history. Andrea Barrett writes historical fiction. Her book Ship Fever won the National Book Award, and her stories are almost always about the men and women whose lives are changed by science, a lot of them scientists. Her newest book, Archangel, consists of five linked short stories that take place in those thrilling, difficult moments when our certainty about the world comes smashing up against new discoveries. Andrea Barrett, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So you have set these five stories in this new book between 1873 and 1939, a time, among other things, that covers the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species to the discovery of nuclear fission. Did you begin with that period as the frame, or did that come after?
You know, it's actually the people that led me through it. There's a young woman who appears in the island. She's a student at a biology course.
This is Henrietta.
Yeah, exactly. And I started to think about what might have happened to her later in life.
Right.
I seem to want to tell something like a complete arc of a story in one place, and then pick it up in another place. So often what I write, it's neither exactly a bunch of short stories,
right,
nor is it a novel. It's this other kind of intermediate form where things are very closely tied together. There's a lot of links between the pieces, and yet it really is not a novel by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think.
And one of the reasons they give your stories in general give me such pleasure is they are not that a short story about a particular hour on a particular day can't be exquisite and wonderful, but yours tend not to be. Yours tend to be big, epic short stories.
I like to think of them as little tiny novels.
Well, in one of these little tiny novels, we meet your young teacher, Henrietta Atkins, who's studying under America's leading naturalist of the late 19th century. This is 10 years after Origin of Species, mm-hmm, and the guy refuses to accept Darwin. Now, this character seems like the spitting image of the famous real-life scientist and Harvard professor Louis Agassiz.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just name him?
You know, I wrote versions in which I named him, but it somehow seemed to shift the focus too much to the biographical issues,
uh-huh,
of his life and less to him as the embodiment of that very, very slow and long resistance of America to the ideas of Darwinism. We were behind everybody else in the world in terms of how we responded to Darwin. It took much longer for those ideas to penetrate.
You're using the past tense improperly here. It is taking much longer.
That is so true. And that, you know, that was on my mind too as I was writing the story. So I wanted the focus to be there and not on Agassiz, who's, mm-hmm, a very interesting man, and someone else could write a whole very good novel about his life, his wife, all the work he did. He's fascinating, but that wasn't what I was doing here.
Right. You in this book, you focus a lot on the losers in the game of discovery. History is written, uh-huh, by winners and about winners. Why are these sort of various forms of dead enders and losers interesting to you?
It's partly the sense that the losers now aren't always the losers later. When you're a working scientist, the same as when you're a working writer, you're just living your life in that moment and working with those ideas in that moment. And you don't know that you're a loser or a
right.
winner. You're just with the work. And that does fascinate me.
The astrophysicist Mario Livio has a new book about scientists getting it wrong. And he makes the point that Darwin wasn't quite wrong, just unavoidably ignorant because heredity and genetics hadn't been discovered yet, and so he didn't
He knew nothing.
Yeah.
Well, he couldn't get it. There was nothing to get in that sense.
Exactly.
I mean, without the ideas, the hypothesis he made about how traits are actually transmitted to us now, knowing what DNA is, knowing some of the
right.
ways in which this works, they seem so bizarre.
So nobody's right or wrong all the time.
Not even close, I don't think.
Yeah. Are there any certainties that you think people cling to now that might be ripe for fiction that and might be ripe for discrediting in the same way 50 or 100 or 200 years hence?
The whole debate about climate change just fascinates me endlessly because no matter how much evidence working scientists bring forth in front of the public that this is happening and the other thing is happening and there's data on data and data, lots of people still don't believe it. They think it's made up. And so that idea of what is evidence, how much evidence or data do you need to convince someone of a politically difficult or emotionally difficult position, that's what really fascinates me. And I think that's what drove some of the stories in the book. There's ways in which each of these stories is at kind of a very base level, trying to think about the question of what is evidence? What does it mean to do an experiment and get an answer? What does it mean to have an answer? How many answers do you need to be convinced of something? I'm not a working scientist, so I don't really know how that works, but I'm very interested in it.
You're not a working scientist, although you studied biology and zoology as a student. In terms of your general disposition and even writerly methods, do you think you behave more scientifically than typical fiction writers do?
I don't know. My guess is actually not. I know more science than typical writers do because I had a little flirtation with it when I was young, and so I'm not afraid of it now. I will go look at scientific papers or read articles without any sense that, oh, I can't possibly understand this, because I know I can understand
right.
some of it. I just can't understand the math. But my actual working process is so chaotic and so intuitive. And it's actually much stupider and more intuitive than most fiction writers I know. I don't start from an outline. I don't know where I'm going. I don't have a plan. I don't have anything when I start. I just write terrible first drafts.
Yeah, I've read about you're bragging about your horrible first drafts. But you also, not only in this book do characters pop up here and there in different times and places, they pop up from book to book at different ages and different times and places. So in your chaos, do you try to keep a catalog of how that's supposed to work?
I actually have a big, gigantic family tree done in pencil so I can erase it. And I just keep adding people and adding dates, and they keep having children and developing cousins. And it's clearly a compulsion. Even I understand that.
Yeah.
And it's also another way of someone outside me had to tell me this, but it resonated enough that now it seems true. If you're working a lot with biological metaphors and with ideas from genetics and evolution, there's a lot to be said for having a cast of characters that are all connected and in whom traits can
right.
move through generations and link up to other things. That really wasn't conscious on my part,
right.
But now I look at it and think, oh, yeah, I could work with that. That makes sense.
And what about setting? Do you have any yearning to set things in the future and do what we call science fiction?
I don't know if I'll ever try it or not. It seems kind of fun at this late date.
Yes, I would welcome that.
Oh, thank you. Now I'm inspired.
Good. Andrea Barrett, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Andrea Barrett's new book, Archangel, is out right now. As I mentioned to Andrea, I recently read an excellent new nonfiction book about mistakes made by scientific superstars like Darwin and Einstein and Lord Kelvin, all regarded as unimpeachable geniuses now, of course. But over the course of their careers, all of them got something big wrong. The book is called Brilliant Blunders, and it's by the NASA astrophysicist Mario Livio. He thinks it's important to remember the big missteps as well as the moments of genius because science requires both.
It has occurred to me that science is presented as this sort of direct march to the truth. And being a scientist myself, I know that that's very far from the truth. So I really wanted, you know, to give this picture of this zigzag path with lots of false starts and so on.
Which is why this book is so valuable. So at the risk of giving aid and comfort to anti-scientific creationists, let's take the theory of evolution. What was flawed about it?
So, you know, Darwin didn't know any genetics, and we cannot blame him for that. I mean, nobody knew genetics at the time. But he adopted the theory of blending heredity, namely that the characteristics of the two parents get mixed like gin and tonic or like paints. And what he didn't realize, and that was his blunder, that with such a theory, actually natural selection could never have really worked.
Because you'd know exactly what was going to happen forever.
Well,
no mutations possible.
There are no mutations. And plus, you know, the characteristic that you wanted to preserve, I mean, gets diluted very, very fast and, in fact, disappears from the population instead of shifting the entire population into that direction.
Right.
One thing that he understood, which was really fantastic, and you wonder why anybody else did not immediately understand, was that he said, look, if I take a distinct male and distinct female, they also produce a distinct male or female and not some intermediate hermaphrodite.
Yeah.
So,
Good point.
Yeah. So he noticed that there was a problem there. He just didn't know how to correct it.
Yeah. There are some scientists you write about who are so intent on rejecting things they don't understand, or in the particular case of Albert Einstein, aren't mathematically consistent. Explain his idea of the cosmological constant and the trouble that caused him.
So Einstein thought that the universe was static, that nothing was moving, because at the time when he tried to apply his theory of general relativity to the universe, 1917, we didn't know that the universe is not static. But he knew that there is gravity everywhere. Everything attracts everything else. So how can it be static? This thing should just be collapsing. So he added this term into his equations, which was not easy, by the way, to add a term that would still leave all the principles intact, which added a repulsive gravity, which exactly balanced the attractive gravity that existed there to keep everything in place.
So the math required him to create this X factor, even though we have no idea what it is.
Right. Now, in the late 1920s, you know, astronomers discovered that the universe is in fact expanding. Once Einstein heard that, he said, but wait a second, if it's all expanding, I don't need this accurate balance because all that gravity would do, it would slow down the expansion. So he regretted having put that term in and pulled it out of his equation, even though it was allowed by the principles of the theory.
And what did subsequent science do to that?
Well, 15 years ago, actually precisely in 1998, two groups of astronomers discovered that our universe is not only expanding, the expansion is speeding up, it's accelerating. And as far as we can tell, at least to this point, the thing that's driving this speeding up is precisely that extra repulsive term that Einstein has put originally into his equation.
So he was more or less right the first time.
Yes. He was more right the first time than by taking it out.
So are there ways for scientists to sort of keep shaking up their assumptions about, oh, this is right, this is wrong? Musicians can improvise. Writers can switch back and forth between the third person and first person to give themselves a new sense of narrative reality. Are there any equivalents in science?
So, you know, I think that the 20th century perhaps has seen some of this happening in almost every area of creative processes, right? I mean, this is where you get the most discomfort from some people with music, with visual arts. And you also get the big revolutions in physics, you know, quantum mechanics, general relativity, which, you know, go against our everyday intuition of things as basic as space and time, you know, and so on. So I think, yes, and it is perhaps interesting, you know, that these types of revolutions appear to happen somewhat coincidentally, you know. I mean, so you start to think, okay, maybe the connections are not direct, but still people think in certain ways.
Right. But can individual scientists try to sort of stay on their game and keep their minds open? Is that possible once you've gone so far down your particular little specialty and your sense of what's true?
Yeah, but it is still the case that, you know, I mean, if you're stuck in some sort of a minimum and you want to get out of that, you need some sort of a larger perturbation. You cannot rely on some infinitesimal change, you know, that will get you to a big discovery.
Right. String theory in particle physics is the big, cool, new theory that all the cool kids believe. It's this dramatic, ambitious, big leap, but unproven and maybe unprovable. As you think about blunders and have spent so much time looking at this, do you have a hunch that 50 or 100 years from now we'll see that we'll have had a brilliant blunder at its core, maybe toward the truth, but in this, in some fundamental way, not the truth?
We might do. I mean, one of the problems with blunders is that you can only tell that there are blunders after the fact. String theory or M theory is our current best attempt at unifying all the forces of nature. But as you point out, there are no real experimental evidence for it. So it could turn out to be, a wrong direction, and maybe we will need to go in another direction. But you know, it is still the case that a lot of very interesting mathematics and many, many interesting ideas have been developed, so that I think even if it will turn out to be a blunder, it will most probably be a brilliant blunder.
Mario Livio, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mario Livio's new book is called Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein. As the shrinks say, I'm afraid your hour is up now. Thank you very much for listening. If you can't wait until next week to hear from us again, visit us on Twitter. We're at Studio 360 Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. And if you're more of a Facebook person, the show and I are both there as well. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Posey Gruner,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music, as always, is by David Van Tiekum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the first opera for the internet age.
The technology is just a delivery system, right? But the motor behind the thing is this sort of fundamental loneliness.
The great young composer Nico Muhly on his opera Two Boys. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.